school now and follow your post-earthquake drill procedures. This is only a test. The following tones will conclude this test.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Ralph Nader in Portland rally to get big money out of politics, taking place Saturday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Ralph Nader, along with local progressive leaders, will speak in support of the Get Big Money Out of Politics effort on the Multnomah County November ballot. There will also be a book signing and Q&A after the speech. Again, that's Ralph Nader Rally in Portland, Saturday, October 22nd at 6 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1121 Southwest Main Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Stephouse Networks, offering high-speed residential and business internet services throughout the Portland area. More information about Stephouse Internet Services is available at 503-548-2000 or at stephouse.net.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers. I'm speaking with Gina Oshner, who teaches at Columbia University, where she also directs the Portals Writing Conference. She teaches with the Seattle Pacific Low Residency MFA program. She has been awarded a John L. Simon Guggenheim Grant and a grant from the National Endowment of the Arts. Her stories have appeared in The New Yorker, Tin House, Glimmer Train, and The Kenyon Review. Gina Oshner is the author of the short story collection, The Necessary Grace to Fall, which received the Flannery O'Connor Award for Short Fiction, and the story collection, People I Wanted to Be. Both books received the Oregon Book Award. A novel entitled The Russian Dream Book of Color and Flight received the Grub Street Book Prize in 2011 and was long listed for the Orange Prize in 2010. Gina Oshner lives in Kaiser, Oregon, and she joins us today in the KBOO studios. Gina Oshner, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, Kathleen. It's my sincere pleasure to be here.
Today we're going to talk about your new book, The Hidden Letters of Velta B. This novel is a poetic story about family relationships. It's also a story within a story. The narrator, Inara, a Latvian woman, is dying, and during her last moments on Earth, she shares her grandmother Velta's letters with her son, Maris. Young Maris inherited extremely large ears and the gift of near ultrasonic hearing. Gina, your new book, as I said, The Hidden Letters of Velta B, is told from the point of view of Inara, who is dying of lymphoma. She is sharing the stories of her family, their village, and Latvian history with her grown son, Maris. And Maris grew up being teased and tormented by his classmates and others because he has these extremely large furry ears and hears not only things that other people can't hear, but also true heartaches lurking beneath his mother's confessions to him. It's quite an extraordinary ability to have. Can we start with a reading from the beginning of Hidden Letters of Velta B to hear a little bit more about how she is telling Maris the stories?
Absolutely. So this does come right from the beginning. Your first day of third grade, the leaves crisped on the trees, curling orange, red, yellow. They crunched like brittle paper beneath our feet as we walked down our lane. The closer we drew to the school, the slower you moved. We spied other kids galloping toward the schoolhouse, their mothers in tow, juggling book bags, purses, and mandatory first day gifts for the new teacher. Yellow apples, embroidered handkerchiefs, chocolates. You had no book bag. I had no gifts. This was our third attempt in as many years to get through the dreaded first day. I had a pair of extra-large aviator muffs, and these I slipped over your extra-large ears, as much to protect the tender cartilage as to dampen the colossal noise of the schoolyard. Outside the wooden school doors, you grabbed my sleeve, turned to me. I know I am peculiar, you said, but am I too peculiar? The verbal torment at the hands of schoolmates, the pain inflicted by well-intentioned neighbors, that's what I heard in your voice. What I said, my hand on each of your narrow shoulders, Maris, you are fearfully and wonderfully made. It's a verse from the Psalms, one of my favorites, and I said it because I know the power words have. I've read Genesis. I read how God spoke every blade of grass into being with three little words, let there be. The words, all potential, all possibility, speaking a story makes it happen. And so I told you a story, told you it was yours. A long time ago, so long ago no one remembers when, Bear Slayer Boy rose out of the river's mud, his ears enormous, trimmed with fur and as large as meat pies. With those ears, he could hear the stirrings of field mice three countries away. His gifts of discernment were unparalleled. Bear Slayer could hear how the heartbeat changes, how the voice tightens when someone tells a lie. He could hear the sweet caroling of the songbirds, and he knew what the fish in the river were thinking. Smart and wise, Bear Slayer, though a boy, was also strong and courageous. Once, when he was walking in the woods, a bear ambushed him. Without hesitation, Bear Slayer, using only his hands, slew that bear, ripping it apart at the jaws. This story is a door opening, a door closing. The words are hinges, self-oiling through the act of repeated recitation. Repetition being a form of love, I told you the story every night during those magical, swift years of your childhood. How big were those ears? You often asked, your voice small in the growing darkness. Bigger than mine? You needed to know you were not alone in your oddity, that your outsized ears were not a mistake, but a marvel. I leaned over you, turning chant to parable, these words being like interlocking teeth of a zipper. You unzipped the teeth of the story, crawled inside its dark, capacious interior, and made it your own.
Thank you. That passage refers to the idea of the story in so many different ways. Can you talk a little bit about how you see the importance of story and how it relates to this novel, The Hidden Letters of Velta B?
Yeah, I think story is absolutely essential to this story, which, as you noted, it is built upon layers and layers of story. So we have this Bear Slayer myth that every Latvian knows and tells, and it's a story that they love. They told it during the occupations. It was a story that gave hope when Latvia was being occupied by first the Russians, then the Germans, then the Soviets. And it was something that could be a banner under which people could rally. But story is essential as a binding thread throughout the different narratives that people tell in this story. They have very conflicting, diverse, alternate, colliding accounts of history, which I think is probably true in a lot of countries, but it's true in Latvia because there's the history that the Soviets wrote for them, as occupiers often do. There's the true Latvian history that many Latvians know but aren't talking about because there are painful things there. And then there's the history that's slowly being approved, but no one can exactly agree on everything. There's that history. And then there's the history of as you mentioned, Velta's letters that get revealed midway through the book. There's other history there. Again, very painful. So there are reasons, I think, why we need stories. We need stories to tell us what we believe in, what life is meant for, what's important, how to live. And stories are a form of healing. And so all of these elements come together in the act of storytelling, which is why Inara feels compelled to tell her son all of these stories.
And there were some lines in the book that caught my attention related to stories. At one point you say, why we must tell our stories, sing our songs. This is how we forgive and are forgiven. Which I guess relates to what you just said in a lot of ways. Yeah. And another line, a story is a cloak thicker and more knotted than we suppose, and you compare it to lace.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, there's power in a story, and what isn't said is sometimes is as significant, if not more so, than what is said, what is seen and visible.
There are throughout the book also these songs, these Dinas.
Dinas, yes.
D-A-I-N-A is how it's spelled. Is that Latvian?
Yes, it is. It is a Latvian term. In Lithuanian, it's dainos. In Latvia, it's dainas. And there's a wonderful story about how these all came to be. And they are very, very old songs that are sung. And some are sung for at funerals, some at weddings, songs that describe how to plow a field, songs that describe the correct way to bake bread, how to court and marry, special songs sung on June 24th, Ligo Day, the Ligo songs. So there's hundreds and hundreds and thousands of these songs. And at some point in the mid-19th century, Kristaps Barents realized not everyone was singing them as much as they used to, and he feared that people might start forgetting them. So while the Grimm brothers were collecting fairy tales in Germany, he went about and started collecting all of these dainas. And he asked people in the different provinces and areas of Latvia, please write them down and send them to him. And it's this wonderful story about how little tiny slips of paper came flooding through the mail to him. And over the course of several years, he started compiling and trying to sort them and find a pattern between them all. And he collected something like, I'm going to say something like 100,000 of them. There are more than that, but that's what he could collect. And because of his work, the Diana as a metrical form, as a song, as poetry, is very robust, alive and well in Latvia.
Really?
And in fact, when I visited, one of the first things somebody shared with me was a Diana, and I included it in the book. But she said, if you want to understand Latvian culture, let me share with you this. And she said, trouble, my big trouble, I put it under a stone and I stepped over it lightly.
That's great. And so that brings up the question, why Latvia?
Yes. Yes, it's like the perfect obvious question because I'm not Latvian. My parents aren't Latvian. Nobody in our family is. I have no direct links or ties to Latvia. And I think I just got bit by the Latvian bug at some point in 2004, 2005, somewhere around there. I ran across a book by Agate Netsulis called Woman in Amber. And it was so beautiful, so powerful, so sad. And I thought, I've got to find out more about this country and this history. And there's an amazing writer living here in Portland named Paul Stutoni, and he's half Latvian, half Egyptian, I believe, and he wrote a gorgeous story set in Latvia. And at the same time, same summer, I read these two pieces, and I thought, wow, this is so different. I've read stories written about Germany, about Poland, about occupation in World War II and the rebuilding years. I've seen stories written from those perspectives on history, and this was so different, and also different in language register, in the lyric register, in the syntax. There was a difference, and I thought, this is totally unique. I have to find out more. So that prompted a visit to a bookstore where I shared the same story with you. I've read these pieces. They're so different. You have to help me find everything you can about Latvia. And the woman's eyes got very big, and she said, nobody comes in here asking about Latvia, ever. I said, well, you've got to help me. Can you help me? And she pointed to her name tag, and she said, I might be able to help you. And her name tag said, Dace. She said, my name's Dace, and I'm Latvian. And it was like one of those, you couldn't ask for, it was miraculous, really. You couldn't ask for anything better. So that began an 11-year friendship in which she tried to teach me Latvian and also set before me like little series, little tests. You know, if you really want to understand Latvian culture, you need to go check this out. You need to go research X, Y, Z. She said, you need to go to Riga. You need to stand in the river. If you stand in the river, you need to get some mud. If you get some mud, you have to put it in a little jar and bring it back to me. You know, so there are all these cool things. You know, I felt like I was in search of the Holy Grail, and it was wonderful.
Let's talk about the hidden letters themselves. You mentioned those, the letters that Velta wrote. Talk a little bit more about that and why they are so important to Inara.
Yes, so Inara finds in the walls, as she's kind of She's not really supposed to be in this abandoned manor house, but she's there. She's curious. And she's remembering something from childhood. She's remembering that she saw her mother rooting around in the manor house as if looking for something hidden. And so later, when the manor house is acquired by a German couple, she's employed as their housekeeper. And she likes this because it keeps her connected to a little piece of her own family history. And as she's working for them, she comes across, I think in the floorboards it is, she's down there one day and she sees that there's something underneath and she's pulling them out, these letters. And she has a desperate need to feel that she's a very clever girl and she's convinced that she isn't. So she secrets them home. She doesn't tell her mother that she's found anything that could be important. She's aware that her mother's looking for these letters, but in the way that sometimes daughters know just exactly how to hurt their mothers, she doesn't share this piece of information. So she's got these letters and she starts to read them and she realizes that they are not written in a way that is transparent. It's not clear what it is she's reading. It's in Latvian, but it's not clear what it means. It's very opaque. And then some of the letters are written in musical score. So this feels like, okay, here's a challenge. I'll prove I am clever. I will decode this. And eventually she does. And she discovers that what she has decoded is very painful information. And it's the way I think that a lot of people had to process really horrific events that they witnessed or perhaps participated in. Mm-hmm. And that's where the being forgiven, forgiving, and being forgiven comes in.
You've talked a little bit about the history of Latvia as we've, you know, started our conversation, but maybe just a little bit more. I mean, I looked up a little bit of Latvian history because I realized I knew virtually nothing about it. And tell a little bit more about the history of Latvia and the importance of the early 1990s.
So I'm with you in the same boat. I did not know much about Latvian history when I first started, and then I met Dace, and she gave me many books that were in her mother's personal library, and she gave me that challenge: you have to go to Riga. So I started reading. I did go to Riga, and one of the first things that I saw in the old downtown, old city area is the Occupation Museum, which is a wonderful museum, and it is all about the history of Latvia, but with particular special emphasis on the years in which Latvia enjoyed a wonderful and spectacular period of independence between 1918 and 1938, and that was kind of the golden years for Latvia. It was the first time that they were not occupied by anybody, and they had elected their first president, and it was a wonderful time for them. And then at the end of 1938, things really began to change, and they were occupied first by Russia, and then the Germans came in, I believe, into 39 or 40, routed the Russians or the Soviets out, and then the Germans were only there for a brief time, and then the Soviets came back through. So in a short amount of time, they had three occupations. And during that time, it was quite possible for a man to be conscripted into one army and then the other and then the other again, or punished because they had been part of one army. Two brothers could be fighting against each other. It was quite possible for something like that to happen. So it was a very divided time and a difficult time for Latvia. And so with that third occupation, which lasted, you know, until the fall of the Soviet Union, a lot of things happened in Latvia that made Latvians, I think, feel like they were being punished for being Latvian. So it was all Russian spoken in the schools at one point. People were told, you want to speak Latvian, fine, but, you know, you do it quietly elsewhere.
And Inara is tells of being chastised for speaking Latvian.
Yes, and I was told stories like this often, so I think it wasn't uncommon to have a not so subtle message that Russian is better. So the history books would take things like inventions that were invented by Latvians and ascribe them to someone else. So I think Latvians felt like their history wasn't their own. Their language was being overwhelmed. The population and the demographic ratios and representation, I think they felt they were being overwhelmed. And at one point in Riga, there were as many Russians as Latvians. And I think that this is where the Dainas became important. This is where something like a story like Bear Slayer becomes important. It pulls people together, and it reminds them of national identity and the fact that they once had been an independent country, and that's very important to Latvians. So they weathered the hard years and came out on the other side. When the Soviet Union withdrew, it was for Latvians a wonderful thing, great rejoicing. There was economic hardship, however. It wasn't perfect. It wasn't a completely seamless transition. And so there was in 92, 93, 94, those were difficult years, as they were for all of the countries that had broken away, very difficult time economically. So this is where the curtain opens on the story. Those difficult economic years, the year after the Soviet Union has dissolved, and people are trying to figure out what to do. The lat had been devalued. People lost their savings overnight. So they're just trying to pick the pieces up and move on.
And you also refer to this, the different groups, that their representations of the different groups in your book, The Hidden Letters of Velta, be the, I guess you would call them the indigenous Latvians, because they're indigenous people there, right?
Yeah.
The indigenous Latvians, and then the various groups, the Russians, the Germans, the Jews, and they're represented within the characters, yes, in your book, and their attempts to get along.
Yes.
If you can talk a little bit about how you imagined that, these different kinds of people would interact and have conflict and sometimes mesh.
Yes, they mesh and they don't mesh. They're in a small town, and I love small towns. They're great because it's a blessing and a curse. Everybody knows everybody else's business. So I thought, I must set this in a small town where everybody knows. And who better? Who would know more than the people who are the grave diggers? They'll know all of the secrets, good and bad, about people. So I made 5 trips, 3 of them to Eastern Latvia, and I decided this is the best area, because there are so many small little towns, and interestingly enough, they are populated by Jews and Roma and people of German background, Poles, Lithuanians, predominantly a Latvian-Russian mixture, but there are these other elements there. So it was the perfect place to go. And I thought, when I went to this very little town, so small I can't find it on a map, it's called Tilja, and the nearest town that is on the map is Balvi. And I went there and I thought, aha, I'm going to see conflict everywhere. I'm going to see people just so upset with each other, and they're going to be fighting about the language referendum and language law issues and politics. And I asked my host, could she show me around a little? Could I go? And she was a teacher. Could I sit in and just observe? And after about a week of this, going everywhere, different churches, different classrooms, town hall, walking around, I said, there's a problem here. Nobody's at each other's throats. If at anything, I think the most exciting moment was somebody was arguing over a shovel. And she said, you know, we get along pretty well. We've been doing this for hundreds of years. I had come with, I had done the typical traveler thing. I had read some things. I had formed some assumptions. I thought Russians and Latvians must just hate each other. Well, they don't. And so that was something that was very illuminating to me and good. I think a good thing for me to learn. Mm-hmm. Of course, people get upset from time to time. But what I was hearing in Riga, where there was some contention regarding language issues, and there was some animosity I did see between Russians and Latvians over their ethnicity, I didn't see that in the East. And that was very important for me to know, that there is no unifying statement that covers everybody in the country.
And so the conflicts that do happen in the novel are the kind of conflicts that happen between lots of people, perhaps not necessarily because there are ethnic differences.
Right. It's more about class. I mean, who doesn't feel the injustice of somebody who has way more than they know what to do with coming in and buying up all the land? That's a socioeconomic class conflict.
Right.
It had nothing to do with Mr. Zetsche being German or Inara's family being Latvian. It just so happens that that's what they were. It was about the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah. Right, and he's the new owner of the old cemetery, too.
Yes.
Just totally desecrates it.
Yes.
What he requires his workers to do to it, or his...
Yes, he does the unthinkable, and he asks Inara's father and their family to relocate all of the bodies so that he can develop this choice piece of land. And it is utterly unthinkable, but they do it anyway. Mm-hmm. Why? Because he promises, I think I can turn your economic nightmare around. I think this will bring jobs to this little town where they need it. Mm-hmm. And so they go for it.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Gina Oshner. We're talking about her new book, and it is called The Hidden Letters of Velta B. This is Kathleen Stevenson. You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO Portland. How did you get the idea for Morris to have those big fuzzy ears, or furry ears, which give him these extra powers?
Yeah. Well, when I was on a first visit to Latvia, I was in Riga, and I noticed that there was the very large, you know, main drag going through town was called Lajplaisis Street. And I asked, what is that? And they said, oh, that's Bear Slayer Street. Mm-hmm. Well, so then I had to know who's Bear Slayer, and then I got the story. And then it seemed the perfect metaphor, and making a metaphor literal, that's all the fun of fiction. So it seemed natural and organic to the story that somebody's going to have these big, enormous ears. And so then this boy does, and people think, aha, he's our savior. He will do something. And it's that reversal of expectation. The ears do something, but not what people think.
And he inherits them. His father had them too. Yeah. In reading about your novel, sometimes it's been referred to in reviews as magic realism. Do you see it in that category? Do you care about that categorization, or how do you feel?
Yeah, I think it's a story that's built upon myth, so it's going to start wobbling in that direction once the writer starts employing things like, you know, boys with enormous ears. I don't mind it a bit if somebody calls it that. I think there's enough there that applies universally, that is realistic, that I think a person who's reading this and they like magic realism or don't can still find something there that keeps them reading and keeps them turning the pages. But the magic realism, you know, it's really just a funhouse mirror. It's just a warped mirror through which to reveal reality. So you can't go very far with magic realism before you're really writing realism. It's just an extended metaphor.
Now, you live in Kaiser, Oregon. Many years ago, I live very close to Kaiser, and I think near the border of where Salem meets Kaiser.
Okay.
And I've got to say, I never associated someone who would be writing a version of magic realism living in Kaiser, based on what I know of that area. And you've mentioned that in an interview that your life is kind of much more boring than the novels that you write. Can you talk about how do you get that that storytelling ability from a very normal kind of... You have four children?
Four. Two of them are out of the house. They have flown. They circle every now and then when they sense that food might be nearby. But there's still two in the house. And the quotidian, the ordinary, the boring, the dishes, the laundry, it's there. It's part of life. And I think that early on, I realized I love to read. I'm a girl who grew up around stories. I loved fairy tales. I was so lucky to have a mom who read to me. I had a grandfather who's very much like some of the more bombastic characters in here, who would tell the most outlandish, outrageous tales. And we knew this has to be a lie. This cannot possibly be true. But he told it so well, we never wanted him to stop telling it. No one ever asked him, did that really happen? So I feel lucky to have been around people who like words, who like stories, who tell stories, and I think that must have worked on my imagination early on.
Mm-hmm. I would like to ask you a little bit more about some of the aspects that you just mentioned in this book. These talk about Bombastic, this Uncle Morris, who is who's Morris, young Morris is named after. He's an interesting character. Can you talk a little about him and the role he plays in the novel?
Yes. In earlier drafting, in earlier versions, he had a larger role, but we realized he was so bombastic, he threatened to run away with the narrative entirely. So in the revision process, he was pared back a little bit. He's important because he is the reason someone like Little Morris needs to come along. Mm-hmm. People like Uncle Morris, probably well-intentioned, but just completely politically incorrect, saying all the wrong things, hurtful things, doing great harm to the family in his drunken rages. He represents a person who is utterly unreconciled. And his idea of having a pure, all-Latvian Latvia with only ethnic Latvians in it is ridiculous, and anyone living there would know this. And yet he persists in his folly, and so, you know, he's a perfect example of somebody who's just a little too patriotic, and in being that way, causes great distress and harm for our narrator and the rest of the family. And so, yes, he is the reason why someone like Little Morris needs to come along and use what he can hear as a means for forging reconciliation between people.
Yeah, he lost a leg.
He lost a leg in Afghanistan.
And when would he have been in Afghanistan? Just to
1978, 79, I think up into 81, 82. It's the Soviet Union's Vietnam. It's their bad war that they could never win, and it's the war that people aren't happy to talk about. And it was the practice in those days to send people from Latvia, Lithuania, Kazakhstan, far reaches of the Soviet domain, and send them to the unpopular, ugly wars.
We're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask, is this an area that you will continue to write about, setting things in this area, or do you think you're not going to be writing about this particular area anymore?
Yeah, I don't know if I will do if I'll do a great amount of work in the Baltics in terms of research and pursuing other narrative ideas. Right now, I'm focusing on Bulgaria and Romania and Moldova. There's a very, very interesting group of Roma people who traditionally, you know, maybe like 80 years ago, 90 years ago, this particular group, they would have been the ones who would have trained bears and then tamed them and then taken them to shows and fairs and things like that. They're called the Ursari, and I've stayed with a couple of different families. They don't have bears anymore. Now they're expert metal workers. So I'm curious, when did they stop doing this? Why did they stop? Mm-hmm. What did it mean to them when they were doing that kind of work? And they are also... this particular smaller group of Romani are literate and do quite a bit of reading and writing and are well-versed in literature, which makes them very, very interesting because most of the other groups, Romani groups around them, are not literate and have no desire to be. So I'm curious, how did they learn to read? Who taught them? Why did they decide this was important? Because mm-hmm. you don't put that together usually with first of all, Romani, and then secondly, traveling Romani who are animal tamers.
Well, that sounds like a lot of potential.
We'll see.
Layers and layers there,
and
too,
layers.
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay, well, Gina Ochsner, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Thank you very much, and let me let people know again that the title of your new book, your latest book, is The Hidden Letters of Velta B, and my guest has been Gina Ochsner. I'll spell Gina's last name just because because sometimes people want to look it up. It's O-C-H-S-N-E-R. And Gina Oceaner will be at Woodstock on November 5th. That's Saturday, November 5th. At 10 a.m., she'll be part of a panel called Skeletons in the Closet, Family Secrets. That's at 10 a.m. at the Winningstadt Theater. And she will also appear as part of Lit Crawl that day at an event called Mushroom Foraging with Gina Oceaner and Alexis M. Smith. That again, November 5th, and that's at 6 p.m. at the Cleaners at the Ace Hotel. That's at 1022 Southwest Stark. So again, Gina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Kathleen.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Between the Covers on KBOO Portland. If you want to hear this interview again, you can go to our website later today, kboo.fm/betweenthecovers. And this is Kathleen Stevenson in studio, and we just heard the interview with Oregon author Gina Oceaner, who will, as I mentioned, be appearing at Woodstock on November 5th. And now we're going to talk about Woodstock, Portland's book festival, with Amanda Bullock, Woodstock Festival Director. Amanda, welcome. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Let's start by getting a general idea of what Woodstock is for people who may not know.
Sure. Woodstock is a one-day intergenerational celebration of books, reading, stories, and literature, in a nutshell. So that means onstage author events, that means writing workshops, events for children and all ages, live music, a beer tent, 'cause Portland, and food carts, and much, much more, actually.
Right. And when you say intergenerational, it's to get at the idea that all generations are welcome?
Yes, exactly. Readers from 0 to 100 and of all kinds of books. We really hope that there's something for everybody and strive for there to be something for everybody at the festival.
What role does literary arts play in this event?
Yeah, literary arts is presenting the festival for the second year. Woodstock used to be run by Woodstock for 9 years. And then last year, in 2014, Literary Arts acquired the festival. It was a friendly process. It wasn't like a hostile takeover or anything like that. The festival approached Literary Arts. And last year, we relaunched the festival as a program of literary arts, moving to downtown. Our base is at the Portland Art Museum. And this year, we've expanded into a total of 8 venues on the South Park blocks. So we're really running the show now with the help of course, hundreds of volunteers and many other people.
Right. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the history and the sort of almost like a revival of Woodstock a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. What kind of changes did you make when you took it over, when Literary Arts took it over?
Sure. So one of the big changes was moving from the convention center to downtown. It's really important to us that the festival feels Portland, feels like it could only happen here, and is very grounded in Portland and the culture and the great things that are happening in this city. And I think that happened before I got here, but I really agree with that decision. And the Portland Art Museum has been an amazing, amazing partner, and we're really grateful for that collaboration. We also moved it from 2 days to 1 day. So it's still a lot happening in that single day, but I think that that's a good fit for the kind of festival that we're throwing. We introduced Lit Crawl Portland as a partner event last year also, which I heard you mention with Gina. Thank you. This year versus last year, Lit Crawl is moving to Friday, the night before the festival, and we'll be downtown as well. We were on the east side last year, but we'll be downtown this year, and it's expanding. So
great. So did I maybe assume something that Gina's appearance at Lit Crawl was on Saturday? Is Lit Crawl on
Lit Crawl's on Friday night. Okay. But it was on Saturday last year. But this year it's on Friday night.
Okay.
So all that information's on the Literary Arts website also.
Yeah. And what is the Literary Arts website?
It's literary-arts.org.
Great. We'll repeat that.
Thank
you. Now, I didn't attend Woodstock last year, but I heard that the crowds were bigger than expected.
They were, yeah. We were getting ready for about 5,000 or 6,000 people, which would have been double the last festival. And 8,500 people came in the rain, which is amazing. Like, that means that Portland is ready for this festival. And I think it's an amazing mandate for the event and response to what we built. So our first project this year was to create space to accommodate those numbers of people. So we've improved infrastructure. We've built in, like I said, a lot of breathing room. We actually worked with the city to shut down those two blocks of streets, so there'll be more space for people to move around, and it'll be safer to move between different events. And we've gone from 2 to 8 venues. So
the art museum is sort of the hub.
Yes.
Is that right?
And
so talk a little bit about how someone who is going to the festival, how they might navigate it in the best way to make sure they take advantage of the things they want to take advantage
of. That's a good question. So I would recommend buying your ticket in advance. Advance tickets are $15 on our website, and they'll be $18 the day of. Kids 17 and under and high school students with ID are free, but they can still register and get their ticket ahead of time. Not only do you save a few dollars, but we've built a larger box office infrastructure so that advanced ticket buyers will be able to get into the festival more quickly. So we have a bigger box office this year and more central, which will be actually on Southwest Park Ave in front of the art museum. So first of all, buy your ticket ahead of time. That $15 ticket does come with a $5 voucher that you can spend in the book fair that day. So you get free money to buy books, which is very exciting.
Yeah, talk about the book fair. What is that? What's that like?
It's great. We've expanded that this year as well. We've moved some of the booths out of the Criedel Grand Ballroom, which is on the third floor of the Art Museum's Mark Building, and we've expanded into the Sunken Ballroom on the first floor. So we have two ballrooms, and the book fair features really exciting local, regional, and national publishers of books, of chapbooks, of zines, different MFA programs. So you could go learn about how to start writing, or hone your craft for your own writing. You could discover exciting new work, and of course we have a big bookstore from Powell's selling all of the festival authors' books, and this year Green Bean Bookstore is joining us as well to sell the children's and middle grade author books at that stage. So it's a really great kind of picture of what's happening in the book world right now.
Yeah, I talked to somebody last year that kind of got wasn't able to get around very well because of the crowds, and stayed in the book fair, I think, the
really?
Whole day.
I'm sure the vendors are happy about that. But we've made more space, so hopefully it'll be easier to get around this year, because we definitely heard that, and that was our first priority.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. And so maybe this would be a good time to sort of give people a more specific idea of authors they might encounter or workshops they might encounter.
Sure.
Talk about more specifically about who are some of the, well, I don't even want to use the word highlight.
Yeah, I don't like to pick favorites.
Yeah.
I love all my authors.
I bet. And so I guess I'm going to allow you to pick out a few to just sort of give a range or something like that.
Yeah. The first thing I want to point out is that many authors are appearing multiple times. So we have authors on our 8 stages, our 8 main stages, but then we also have pop-up events, which are in the galleries of the Portland Art Museum, where we pair the written work with the visual art in the museum. So, Gina's book might be in front of something that's very folkloric or something that's like Eastern European themed. And sometimes it's very on the nose, like the book The Queen of the Night is in front of a portrait of a queen, but sometimes it's a little more of an abstract connection.
Yeah. Great.
And those are really fun. So it's a great kind of way to, you might wander around the museum and stumble on a poet, which is always very exciting for you and the poet. And then there are some authors teaching workshops as well. On stage, we're really excited this year to be in the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall, which gives us a huge space and a chance for a lot of people to see some of the kind of marquee events of the festival. And at the Schnitzer this year, we have Sherman Alexie, who's amazing. Yeah. He has his new picture book, Thunderboy Jr., which we're really excited about. And then at noon at the Schnitzer, Colson Whitehead wow. will be in conversation with Yaj Yessi, who's a debut author. And I'm really looking forward to that conversation. I think the John Krakauer, Barry Lopez event was sort of this nexus of the festival last year. And I think this is our Krakauer Lopez this year. And because the room Colson, is so big.
Colson Whitehead has the new book out.
He has The Underground Railroad. And then Yaz's book, Homegoing, is phenomenal. It's so good. It's a bestseller, and I really loved it. And Rekaya Adams is moderating that discussion. And the hall is so big. The Schnitzer seats over 2,000 people. So I think that's going to be really accessible for a lot of festival attendees. And we're excited to have a stage that large so that so many people can see those.
Mm-hmm. And when we talked with Gina and we mentioned she was is going to be part of a panel.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us a little bit more about the panel idea and maybe some other yeah. sampling of the whole panel
sure.
kind of thing that's going on at Wordstock.
So one of the strengths, I think, of a book festival is this density of authors. You have so many people. We have 100 people who might never be at the same event again. And that's such a great opportunity to explore the way their work intersects and is in conversation with each other. And so the panels this year, I really tried to do multi-genre panels. So we have a lot of panels where there's like a poet in the mix or a graphic novelist in the mix that have people who write both fiction and nonfiction so that they're not strictly divided. There are all poet panels, but so they're not as strictly divided just by those topics. For example, we have a panel called War and the Aftermath that features Maximilian Uriarte, who's an Oregonian who served in the Marines. He did 2 tours in Iraq, and he wrote a fictional graphic novel called The White Donkey that's about Marines in Iraq. And then Sarah Glidden, who wrote a nonfiction graphic work about called Rolling Blackouts that is about journalism, also in the Middle East, and talking to refugees and different people affected by the conflict there. And then the third panelist on there is Solmaz Sharif, who's a poet. Her book, Look, is a National Book Award finalist and also deals directly with American conflict in the Middle East and that kind of stuff. And so I think that that's going to be a fascinating discussion about how we tell these stories and what is fiction and what is nonfiction and journalistic responsibility and
right.
but with pictures, because it's graphic novels.
Right.
So.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it, does that work where each person gives a little presentation and then, or how is
yeah.
a panel discussion usually structured for?
I leave it up to the moderators to really define it, but what we typically have is a very short reading so that people can get a feel for the person's work if they're not familiar with it. And then a moderator leads the discussion. So they've read all the books and have prepared questions about the things that the books have in common and onto the theme of the work. And then it's usually open to the audience for the last 10 or 15 minutes so that people get a chance. Because I think, you know, a festival versus something like a bookstore event or Portland Arts and Lectures, which we love, we're launching tonight, Portland Arts and Lectures, you're so close to the author. Like you're physically, it's more intimate and you have a chance to, you know, meet them at the signing and interact directly with the authors. So most panels will have an audience question.
And so the interaction with the author happens at other places besides the place where the event where they're speaking.
Yeah, most of the authors will be signing books after their event at the Portland Art Museum. So you have a chance to get your book personalized. Makes a great holiday gift if you want to get one for someone else. And then also with the pop-ups, I mean, there's no mics, there's no seats. They're very lo-fi and very kind of like very intimate, actually, in this exciting way. So I think that that's a great opportunity.
How do you, and I mean, what was your role in planning Wordstock?
Yeah. You know, everybody at Literary Arts works on it and a lot of people outside, but this is my primary job at Literary Arts. So I spend all year and more planning the festival. So I book the authors. I work with our venues approach the venues that we expanded into this year. I got the street closure permit. I have a lot of help and we have a really great team. But I most of the year I do kind of everything.
Right.
Yeah.
I get that feeling. And do you, how do you, and I assume other people, decide who to invite, what kind of mix you want? What are the factors involved?
Yeah, that's a huge part of my job and something that I think about a lot. We did meet our goal again this year. We feature half Oregon writers, which we're really proud of. And it's not hard to do with the talent that is in Oregon and in Portland. And so I look at what's coming out this year. Actually, I already have a list going for next year because it is new books. It's books that came out in the last year, 18 months, depending. So I kind of pay attention to what's coming down the pike and what I think other people are going to be interested in, as well as what I'm interested in. We try to be as diverse and inclusive as possible in every aspect of that word, you know, age, geography, race, sexual orientation, genre, especially. We want to make sure we have a wide variety of representation on stage at the festival.
Right. So. And what is the range of genres that you might encounter at Wordstock?
We've got graphic literature, like I mentioned, and poetry. We've got some sci-fi stuff. There's a whole panel on time travel books that also includes graphic novel as well. And there's a great comics exhibit up at Oregon Historical Society right now, which is one of our venues. So a lot of the comics writers are at OHS, which is really cool. We have nonfiction, both narrative nonfiction and more historical. So like, you know, memoir, essay, Sean Levy's new book about Rome.
La Dolce Vita.
Yeah. Fiction, historical fiction, contemporary, kind of realistic modern fiction, magic realist kind of things. So
yeah,
I really try to kind of hit as much as I can. Megan Abbott's coming, who's a really great kind of literary thriller writer. So I'm excited about her too.
So there probably is maybe behind the scenes connection between these authors that are staying here for a short period of time.
Yeah. That's one of the coolest parts about the festivals for authors, I think, because they also get a chance to meet like their literary heroes and people whose work they admire. And, you know, a lot of them are friends and they get a chance to see their friends that live all across the country. And so that's a really important part for us, is to take good care of the authors and make sure that they feel welcome and at home here in Portland.
And if people who are writers who are going to the event that are not part of the event but are going to the event, are there particular aspects of Wordstock that are applicable to people who are writers?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, all writers are readers, I would hope. So anything yeah. where they're talking about books will hopefully be interesting. But we also do have the writing workshops, which my colleague Susan Moore, who runs the Oregon Book Awards, she puts those together. And those feature local writers as well as some of the writers who are coming in for the festival and span all kinds of topics.
So, what's an example of one of those?
Helen Phillips, who's coming in from elsewhere for the festival, is teaching a workshop on flash fiction. We have a workshop on writing young adult literature.
And flash fiction is?
Super short fiction. Really, really short.
Okay.
Yeah, like one sentence even.
Wow.
And Helen's done a lot of work around that and is really, really good. So yeah, writing for the young adult audience. There's a workshop with Betsy Amster about how to find an agent, which I know is of high interest to many writers. So everything from kind of the business of writing to actual craft workshops where you're, you know, doing exercises. I'm actually not a writer, so I've never taken a craft workshop, so I'm not exactly sure how they work.
Right.
But we really try to, again, have a broad range on offer. We do workshops at Literary Arts year-round, and so it's a good way for people to kind of get something a little bit different than what they might be taking at our space, or to kind of, if they've been thinking about taking a class with us, to sample what that might be like.
And you have many partnerships.
Yes.
Talk about the partnerships and what they're like and how they work.
We couldn't do the festival without partners. It's like truly a community-wide effort. You know, I mentioned the Portland Art Museum. They've been a wonderful partner from the get-go. And Multnomah County Library has also been a partner from the beginning of the relaunch of the festival. And their librarians from the Reader's Advisory will be on site. And so they'll be at both areas of the book festival. And if you're like, I have this voucher and I'm not sure how to spend it, the librarians can help you pick what you might be interested in reading and picking up that day at the festival. And so we're really glad to work with them. The IPRC, the Independent Publishing Resource Center, will be there.
Who's going to move in?
Yeah, they're going to be your neighbors.
Yes.
They'll have a print pool, so you'll be able to screen print. I don't know if that's the exact right term, but something like screen printing your very own festival souvenir, which they did last year, which I was really, really exciting. And there's honestly too many partners to name. You know, we have Dennis Uniform, who donated the t-shirts for our volunteers. We have Elephants Delicatessen, who we work with. And I'll get in trouble with our development if I keep naming them and like miss some people.
So, right.
Yeah, but we're really, really grateful to everybody. And it's important to us that it is a community event because we want to be responsive to what the community wants and what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. And the Lit Crawl that's happening on Friday night, a little bit more about that. How does that actually work?
Yeah. So one of the coolest things about Lit Crawl is it's all free. There's no tickets to any of the Lit Crawl events. And Lit Crawl is a national, it's a global actually program now. There's one in Helsinki. And it's the program of Lit Quake, which is just wrapped up in San Francisco as a festival down there. And so the Lit Crawl is in three phases. So it's a progressive event. So it starts down on the South Park blocks, the Art Museum's a venue, and the Art Bar at Portland 5, and a couple other places down there. And the first phase is from 6 to 6:45, and then you'll move a little bit north, and there's a second phase from 7 to 7:45, a third phase from 8 to 8:45, and within each phase, there's many events. There's over 40 events that are a part of the crawl. So if you arrive and something's full, there's probably something around the corner that you might want to go to.
And like one example of one of those events that we mentioned Genius, but there's what's another?
Yeah, there's a make your own zine workshop at Literary Arts. There's a bunch of the local reading series are doing special Lit Crawl events. Get Nervous is doing an all queer reading, which is really exciting. Unchased Readers is doing an event. Dim Summer Book Club. Peacock, Portland Creatives of Color. There's a reading from the Powell's employees, actually, are doing an event at their union shop, which is really cool. And then a lot of the presenting authors, we have an event with the Whiting Awards. So there's a really broad range of really like kind of grassroots things to, you know, the Whiting Awards, which they're actually doing some sort of Pictionary-based thing. So it's going to be very silly in a great way. Yeah. And that's kind of the ethos of Lit Crawl is they like to use the word madcap, but I think of it as unconventional literary events. A lot of them are very interactive or highly themed in unconventional spaces. Like we have the Oregon Ballet School, Rudy's Barbershop, places that you wouldn't typically be like, oh, obviously there will be a book reading here. Because I really believe that book events are fun. Like I don't subscribe to that idea that it's like a someone like droning on and like elbow patches in front of a like leather bound like cigar scented whatever. Maybe that's fun for some people, but I think that Lit Crawl especially really makes book culture and literary events accessible to everybody, and is can be a great way in if you've just, you know, been curious about this sort of thing and and weren't quite ready. So.
Right. Well, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you again, how does someone find out more about this? How does someone pre-register that kind of information?
Yeah, the best hub of information is the website Literary Arts, I'm not going to spell it, but literary-arts.org. You can also follow us at Literary Arts on Twitter, Instagram, and on Facebook. We're just Literary Arts, and we'll be updating about the different events. We have, you know, partner events with the Northwest Film Center and Livewire and Literary Deathmatch, and there's a lot of things going on that weekend, but you can find all the information and where to go for all of that at our website. And you can buy tickets. Again, please buy tickets in advance. You save $3 and you'll get in faster.
And again, the dates that we're talking about?
Yeah, the festival is on Saturday, November 5th. Doors are at 9 and it'll wrap up by 6. The Lit Crawl is the night before on Friday, November 4th from 6 to 9. And tickets are on sale now.
And just briefly, what else is Literary Arts up to these days?
Yeah, we're excited. We're opening our Portland Arts and Lecture season tonight with Louise Erdrich, which we're thrilled about. She's one of the greatest American writers, and we've been really trying to bring her here for a long time, and we're excited that she'll be here. And then in November we have Don DeLillo with Noah Hawley. Yeah, it's like it's a busy fall. We also, you know, our youth programs, our Writers in the Schools program has the College Essay Mentoring Project that's going on right now, where we have mentors come in and help a lot of students who are the first people in their family to go to college or who just need some help writing that entrance essay. So that's going on with that program. The Oregon Book Awards are in the middle of deciding the finalists and things like that. So that's a very secret process that I'm not allowed to know what's happening. And then our Delve Reader seminars and our writing workshops are taking place at the space, as well as at literary arts events. We do free events in our community space downtown pretty much weekly or more. So
great.
Well, keep them busy.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's a lot of information and a lot of activity, and it's great to hear about it. And
thank
let
you.
People, who, especially people who are interested in books and literature, it's great to let them know about it. So thank you very much, Amanda Bullock.
Thank you. Thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah, you're welcome. Wordstock Festival Director, talking about Wordstock coming up on November 5th and Lit Crawl coming up on Friday, November 4th, the night before. Again, this has been Kathleen Stevenson today on Between the Covers. Thank you for listening. If you missed any of today's program, want to hear it again, you can go to kboo.fm/betweenthecovers later today. Thanks to Rock for engineering, and stay tuned for reggae music coming right up.
Join me Friday, October 21st from 8 p.m. until 10 p.m. for From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and political commentary. On Friday, October 21st, we will continue with P-Funk and politics, where fantasy is reality, on 90.7 FM, KBOO.
Fantasy is reality.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Space is the Place, showing Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. Space is the Place is an Afrofuturist science fiction classic film released in 1974. Sun Ra, space age prophet, philosopher and Afro-jazz bandleader, lands his spaceship in Oakland, expanding the cosmic consciousness of African Americans. Again, that's Space is the Place, Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of your homepage under Community Events. Thank you.
Shocks of Sheba has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members